Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio for a continuation of our look back into 2019 and before and see what's happening in various branches of science. We've done physics, we've done geology, we've done chemistry, and we've done biology. So you might say, well, what's coming next? Math? Well, no. We're going to go to what I will call, and I may be corrected here, the softer sciences, psychology, and also sociology and anthropology. And I've got an expert of both of those areas here. Eddie Castaneda is the chair of the psychology department here at UT El Paso. And Joe Hyman was a chair, but no longer is a chair of anthropology and sociology. So we've got some experts here. And where shall we start? I think we'll start always on the left. I like the idea of going left. So, Eddie, you're on my left. Tell us what struck your fancy this last year or a few years in psychology.
Thank you, Keith. It's nice to be here. You know, there's so much going on in science, and I was thinking about this quite a bit. It's very hard for me to point to just one thing, one kind of biomedical problem, as much as the idea that there's an evolution taking place in how we approach attacking all these different diseases. It all stems from trying to repair damage or replenish something that's missing in the nervous system most of the time. And so
you're talking about neurological
issues, but even addiction. How do we manipulate the chemistry or the physiology of the brain in all of these different types of disorders? The approach is very different these days with a multidisciplinary effort that comes up with counterintuitive strategies that wouldn't take place if people from different disciplines didn't get together.
So you're going to give us an example of counterintuitive treatments or something?
I'm going to try to do that, definitely.
Yes. Go for it.
Okay, so if we take, for example, Parkinson's disease, in the 1980s, we already knew that there was a depletion of a neurotransmitter dopamine in the brain that's part of a motor system. And because it's depleted, people thought that we need to replenish it. People tried to instill dopamine into plastic pellets and insert those into the brain. But one of the more controversial approaches was to take human brain tissue from aborted fetuses to transplant into the Parkinsonian brain. Obviously, this has some moral dilemmas that accompany that. And so people have looked to coming up with different kinds of tissue that can serve the same purpose. As we become more sophisticated and we're able to manipulate genes, and especially viruses, you know, it's amazing for me to think about how you can take a virus that causes disease and people have been able to slice it, to take out the part that makes you sick, take advantage of the mechanism that infiltrates cells, and then insert into this engineered virus genes that can help replenish dopamine in this specific example.
So are you telling me Parkinson's disease is a viral disease?
No, I'm saying that we're taking advantage of something that's a nuisance for us, a virus, and we're completely turning that around and using that as a tool.
But go back to the Parkinson's, because, you know, what causes that disease?
I think that's a very dangerous question because it can narrow our approach to how we're looking at the disease. We know that there's a genetic basis. We know that there's an environmental basis based on toxins in the world. We know that some people develop from blunt hits to the head eventually. There's a theory called the second hit hypothesis, which says that any of these kinds of environmental or genetic impacts layer on top of the natural neurodegeneration that takes place as we age. By the time we're about 70 or 80 years old, we only have about 30% of this dopamine system intact. What's interesting about this is that in normal people, they have about 10% more. So that speaks to the resiliency of these brain systems, that as they degenerate, you don't see any deficits.
Is it possible, like, say I've reached a certain age and I'm thinking, oh, God, what have I got to look forward to? Can I go and have my dopamine evaluated without having to have brain surgery?
Well, with neuroimaging, you're able to do that, but that's pretty risky. I would say that you can rely on behavioral symptoms.
Okay.
What I meant to say was it's very costly.
Oh, costly.
Yeah, yes.
Uh-huh. Not dangerous.
No, I don't think it's dangerous. Okay. Economically, it hurts your pocket.
So who's in the forefront of this sort of taking viral genetic material and mucking around with it to make it advantageous for people as opposed to problem?
I think that's what I'm talking about. The exciting part of this is that these kinds of manipulations are being used in Alzheimer's disease, multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injury, not just neurodegenerative disorders.
I mean, you say it's being done. This is experimental. I mean, Alzheimer's, for God's sake, everyone's always talking about Alzheimer's because we all think we're going to get it or have it in some level or other. But you're telling me that now there's a treatment?
Yes, it certainly is a treatment now. It's used for extreme cases because it's still quite experimental. But more and more you see human clinical trials taking place with it now.
So it's not something that the Blue Cross Blue Shield is sort of going to foot the bill for on a regular basis?
I don't know about that. Probably not.
Okay.
Probably not.
Where did that work start? I mean, did it start with animal studies?
Absolutely. There's usually a trend to start with animal research, move towards more human-like animals, non-human primates, for example, before we try it on humans. There's a lot of research that has to take place to ensure as much as possible that it's going to be a safe intervention for humans.
Do you still get a sort of an argument against using animals in research? I know PETA, I think it's called, and other organizations are so virulent. There's a point about some maltreatment of animals in research labs. I do know that. But, I mean, is the argument now finished?
It's certainly not finished. There's still quite a few animal welfare and animal activist groups that exist. Working to defend the rights of animals. I think that it's a personal philosophy that each of us embraces about how we're going to use animals in our lives. You know, when we erect a building, we deny animals their living environment. We eat meat. We choose to use animals for food. We use their skins for clothes. We use animals for sports. We use them to hunt. We hunt them. We fish them. There's a lot of ways that we use animals. And when you look at the number of animals that are used in research, it's less than 1% of that in the way that we use animals.
Yeah, I'm very interested.
This is Joe Hyman.
In the bigger question of this progress on how the human brain works. And in my field, in anthropology, my home field, a lot of the progress that's been made in recent decades has been on refining our understanding of the evolution of human beings, and it's clearly something to do with increasingly flexible and powerful and complex brains. You know, now we can't go and recover those brains from the past, or it would take an extraordinary set of circumstances if something survived. So, but we can look at the combination of the size of the skull and the shape of the skull. But at a certain point, the size doesn't seem to matter as much as all of the complicated circuitry that you work on in the present.
So you can have a little head and be quite clever.
And that's what we see.
Good.
We see the heads getting bigger with these more ancestral hominids, these species in the past. But at a certain point, we get, you know, Homo erectus and Homo sapiens, and they have big skulls. But they continue to become more sophisticated in the way they make tools and use technology and adapt to environments. And then so the real question is seeing the looking at the genetics of Homo sapiens, anatomically modern humans, and looking at how it spreads around the world, and looking at the same time at things that they produce that seem to indicate that brain working. Like I just was looking at a story about tools from 70,000 years ago from southern Africa, which is certainly where this evolution first took place. And so these tools have individual maker marks on them.
Oh,
which
are they signed their own?
They marked them, yeah. They signed their own work.
That's mine. When you're
that's mine. And put red ochre, you know, reddish rusty material into the marks
to
designate their own individual personality.
Let me just interject a question, either of you. I mean, we talk about the brain now. We talk about the circuits. We talk about neurons firing, etc. But I've no clue, maybe I should, who was the first group of people to actually begin to open up and look into the brain?
Oh, my goodness. That goes way back to the B.C. area. People were opening up brains to let the spirits out, for example, to try and alleviate mental behavior.
So they opened up the skull for people who were mentally challenged.
Presumably.
In order to let out the vapors and the spirits.
Exactly, yeah. So we can talk about it at that level, you know.
Okay.
Most of the revolutionary work that's more scientifically based takes place probably in the 1800s.
Okay.
And then it's progressed quite a bit.
Is there a classic paper of the 1800s where somebody sort of delineated, oh, this is this part, this is the hippocampus, this controls this, this controls that?
There's two basic approaches that I know about, including getting into the brain and stimulating it electrically and evoking motor responses or sensations.
Right.
As well as damaging the brain in animal models to see what behaviors were lost. Presumably, if you destroy part of the brain that controls a particular behavior, you shouldn't be able to produce that behavior anymore.
Okay, so that's rather hit and miss. At the beginning, anyway.
It was really stimulated in the early 20th century after World War I victims had suffered brain damage and people were noticing things like speech problems.
Was that mainly in Europe or was that U.S., Canada, I mean, around the world at the same time?
In France and Europe in particular. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And from your anthropology point of view, Joe, are there images that people have done, cave drawings? When's the first brain been put on a wall somewhere?
Right, yes. Well, there aren't images of brains that I know of, but there are. One of the first things we have noticed when we systematically study surviving art, much of which is in caves, partly because humans probably thought of the caves as special sacred spaces and partly because the caves are places where things survive.
It's also more comfortable than living outdoors.
In some places, yeah, and safer. So we see things not only that are extremely well done, very well observed observations of nature, such as animals that they were interested in hunting, but also other animals that were perhaps threats, like aggressive wild pigs. But likewise, completely abstract shapes, notable spirals and zigzag kind of arrow shapes.
Do you think that comes from observing weather patterns?
They have meaning that are oftentimes associated with water, with rain and lightning. But it's also been hypothesized, and one of the problems, we don't have time machines, so we look at these things and make up stories, and the most persuasive story becomes what we think happened, most persuasive among the scientists. But we think that some of those things are, and Eddie will know some about this, that are manifestations of visions that shamans had when they were in trance states. And we know that people in trance states see these brightly lit geometrical shapes and so forth. And we know that contemporary people who still have shamanic practices, their shamans make those sorts of drawings and representations of those shapes.
I really like going to the Southwest and finding cliff dwellings and things of that nature where you see human-like pictographs. And I always wonder what those mean.
Yeah, I mean, we have an important location for this right at hand, which is Wiko Tanks, which has been used for millennia as a place for religious ceremonies.
Well, that's a good beginning. We've got to take a short break. This is Keith's panel with Eddie Castaneda and Joe Hyman talking about what advances and what trends they see and what are interesting trends in psychology, sociology, anthropology, etc., etc. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith's panel, Eddie Castaneda and Joe Hyman. And where were we? We were just finishing off a sort of a thought process about neurology. And that leads into, Joe, what's one of the areas that you think have been particularly interesting over the last year or two?
In the last couple of years, there's been a lot of attention to the human impact on the face of the earth. There's a term that has come into wide circulation, the Anthropocene, which is anthro meaning human, and scene meaning like a geological era. And so this is a sort of a joint creation of anthropologists, geographers, and geoscientists to name the era in which you can actually see the face of the earth completely transformed. And there's a lot of attention to this now because of being aware of global climate change.
And I mean, the implication is if you can look back and see a terrain that has been impacted by a civilization of some type or another, and how it has developed or has not developed in subsequent millennia, then we begin to see, hey, wait a minute, let's slow down what we're doing now.
That's right, absolutely. Basis. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we can both see long periods of degradation and change in our environment, but we can also see the process of adaptation and settling into more stable, adaptive
Give us some examples of fields of study in this area that have developed into some understanding.
Right. Well, there was just recently an extraordinary project to pull together data from 240 archaeologists all over the world, in countries throughout the world, so not only the United States, Mexico, Brazil, India, so forth, and to look at the human, how far back you can begin to detect the whole surface of the Earth being significantly changed. And, I mean, there's not one criteria for that, but they did say that we really see the Earth being thoroughly transformed by 3,000 years ago, such as extensive deforestation in the Middle East. The Middle East is, you know, we think of it as this very desert environment, but it's that's in part because of degradation, because of significant deforestation and animal husbandry, like goats that ate everything and obliterated and so forth.
I remember every time I've never been to the Middle East, and I remember listening to news broadcasts over the decades I've been listening, and I always thought Syria would be rather like this, rather hot and dry and warm and not much rain. And then I hear about these floodings and, you know, total, you know, cold weather. And I realized, you know, my concept of the Middle East in terms of climate was totally fouled up.
Right. I mean, we're in this same period, let's say the period from 10,000 years ago to the present. We have had both world warming, that is prior to industrial global warming, the end of the Ice Age. So the last Ice Age, you know, the ends around 10,000 years ago. The world gets hotter, it gets drier, glaciers retreat. So this area around El Paso, Juarez, used to have huge lakes. West of here, there's all sorts of lake basins. And there were human beings here already. And the humans shifted from living in that environment by hunting big animals, which they did at the in the Ice Age periods.
So extinction
to,
almost.
And the big animals die out because big animals are a product of ice ages. Animals get smaller when the weather gets warmer.
Hang on. Now, tell us. I don't know that. Why is there a clear statement coming out of your mouth?
Yeah.
Just cold weather.
But and human, I mean, if humans may have done that.
Bigger and smaller?
Humans may have contributed to this also, I should say. But cold is a way of storing more volume for the amount of surface. It's really a fundamental physical principle. I mean, all the way to human beings. Human beings are thinner, not necessarily shorter or not necessarily taller, but thinner in the tropics and heavier set and rounder. In cold climates, whether it's mountainous or northerly. And so
there's some issues there in a sense. I think of Norwegians as being rather slim and tall.
They're tall. They're
yeah,
among
right.
the tallest people in the
yes.
world. That, not particularly, no. I mean, on a systematic worldwide basis, northerly people are heavy set.
Joe, it seemed to me that as the world warms up, there's more vegetation, and so there's more to eat, and that would be more...
As the world warms up, you begin to get the possibility for agriculture. Mm-hmm. So this is interconnected with the process of domesticating plants and animals. So a great example for this region is corn in Puebla, Oaxaca, Mexico. Corn was a grass that produces seeds that we eventually use as elotes, as cobs of corn. And so that replaces a lot of the lost nutrients that come from the retreat of the ice age or the change of the climates, because they weren't dealing with ice age in central Mexico, but they were with a change in the climate. It gets hotter and drier, so it's not necessarily as lush an environment as that period at the end of the Ice Age, with the decrease in these big animals, which humans further along by killing them as soon as they get their hands on them.
Let me ask a silly question that I don't know much about. How long of a period were these large animals, I mean dinosaur-type animals, and humans cohabiting?
Well, humans never cohabited with dinosaurs. It was never... But we did cohabit with what's sometimes called megafauna, big mammals. So mammoths.
And have we always hunted them? Or were there some big mammoths that were just too big, mammothy?
No. I mean, we hunted them, but the idea of, you know, these brave hunters with their spears standing around, you know, underestimates how intelligent these humans were. Even earlier species like Homo erectus, but especially Homo sapiens. And Homo sapiens would do things like build big traps and drive animals into the traps, or box them up in box canyons and trap them and then kill them there, or drive them off of cliffs.
Okay, let's go back to the...
Because we're smart.
Good. And the animals weren't.
Not quite.
So let's go back to this concept of the Anthropocene. What have you literally learned now we've sort of concentrated on this as a sort of geologic period? What's the major lesson that we've learned by having this bigger vista of ourselves?
I think, first of all, we have realized that we are changing fundamental geological and physical chemical variables in the world. We're not just sort of using the surface of the world. I also think within the Anthropocene, many of us in anthropology and geography think that there's a sub-period, let's call it that, of it's sometimes been called the Capitalocene for capitalism, or you know, it's the industrial era where we have technologies that are so powerful that you can literally clear-cut forests. A perfect example from the El Paso region is that people may not realize this, but much of the region around here was dry grassland. It wasn't desert. So things we see as desert scrub and bare ground and so forth into the 1880s was actually that kind of yellow, dry grass.
Yeah. Which you can still see.
Which you can still go to places, yeah.
And it's just within 20 miles you can
see
this.
So in this sub-period of industrial agriculture, in this case it was bringing in enormous herds of cattle that literally ate their way through the landscape. And it isn't just that they obliterated that grass one time, but the dynamics of the ecology are such that it never returns. It gets replaced with mesquite and creosote and so forth. So we have this. There's a great book from the 1950s, which I hold as an inspiration for all of this, called Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth. Well, women's role, too. But, you know, that was the 1950s. But it was a book that pioneered in talking about how the landscape and the world that we observe has been transformed by human use.
Who's the author?
The editor was named Thomas, and it was a conference sponsored by the Winogrand Foundation and brought together geographers and anthropologists in the 1950s.
Okay. So, I mean, you've learned that lesson, that big farming enterprises can really foul up the land. And yet, you know, we see more and more little farms shutting down, I think. I don't think there's any reversal of that. And big corporate business farms. Is there something to be said that people in your area should be really getting in touch with the political class, or whatever we want to call them, the people that can make laws to say, wait a minute, you know, we've got to do something to reverse this trend? Or is that just pie in the sky?
No, I mean, there are things that can and should be done. The thing that immediately jumps to mind, and this is quite a challenge to all of us, myself included, is reduction in meat eating. That hunting, when human beings were hunting animals, we can see moments when we contributed to the extinction of some species. But in general, when we really start to see these impacts on the environment, we see that with industrial scale production of animals, and in particular ruminants, which are cattle, sheep, and goats. Clearly, cattle is the one that we use the most of.
I think there's also other impacts that's closer to us within cities. One of the issues that's been raised a lot now are socioeconomic impacts regarding people that live close to freeways, for example. The people that live close to freeways are usually low income. They're exposed to more pollution, and as a result, their health issues are much greater.
That is a great example, and there actually are people at UTEP who are specialists in that. Air pollution is a huge challenge. So, I mean, we live in an environment where, frankly, we have too much nutrition. And I'm not saying this from an attitude of like
it's
I'm superior to everybody else.
It's just not distributed appropriately.
It's not distributed appropriately, but we're increasingly suffering from diseases of overdevelopment, overnutrition.
I think we've got about a couple of minutes here. I want to go to one feature about this Anthropocene and the way we treat the land. When I first came to North America, I was told by all sorts of people how the indigenous populations, what I would have called Indians, I don't think that's probably appropriate now, but whatever, they use the land much better, all right? And then later on, stories come out, they were as bad as we were. They'd have campments, they'd squander the resource and move somewhere else.
Yeah, I think
what are those two aspects is correct?
Yeah, they did use the land better, which is not to say that they didn't use it. There's lots of evidence in this Anthropocene of large landscapes being changed by deliberate setting of fires in order to clear farming areas and in order to hunt. But populations like that, there's just not as many people.
Right, it's the smaller
and they don't
impact,
consume as
right.
much, and they don't have as much stuff.
Absolutely. And we don't have enough time. We've run out of this first program. Eddie Castaneda, Chair of Psychology. Joe Hyman, ex-chair of sociology and anthropology. Thank you very much for a very enjoyable conversation.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank
very
you.
Very good. It's a pleasure.
And Sam, thank you very much for putting the program together. And the audience out there will be back next week with the second part of this discussion and conversation with Joe and Eddie. So you make sure you're there. Adios.